Hi, I'm Eric Topol, Editor-in-Chief of Medscape, and I've got a real delight to welcome John Rogers from Northwestern, an engineer who is probably the world leader in imaginative, creative sensor development and understanding how the human body interacts with sensors, and have a real chance to kind of delve into how you've gotten into this field and where you're taking it. So welcome, John.
No, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I look back at your background, and I started to realize that you were a genetic recombination of a woman, a mother who was a poet, and a father as a geophysicist. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. My dad actually got a PhD in atomic and molecular physics, University of Missouri at Rolla. And so he evolved his career toward geophysics because he got a position at Texaco's research lab. So I was born in Rolla, but grew up in Houston, suburbs of Houston, actually, small town.
Sugarland or something?
That's right, yeah.
Sugarland, Texas. Yeah. Sounds pretty good.
And
you went to University of Texas at Austin, and then, what, MIT?
Yeah, I was at MIT for 6 years. I got master's degrees in physics and in chemistry, and then got a PhD in physical chemistry. So.
Yeah, so you got really quite a broad engineering background. Then after that, where were you? What was your next?
Well, I won a junior fellowship at Harvard Society of Fellows. So it's a bit like a super postdoc. It was a 3-year position nominally, but the appeal was that it provided a salary and a stipend, and you could sort of do whatever you wanted. You weren't linked up with a particular faculty member at Harvard. So there was a lot of flexibility with that. I ended up splitting my time between work in a laboratory of a chemist at Harvard, George Whiteside, very famous materials chemist and entrepreneur. And the other half of my time I spent with a startup company that we launched out of MIT based on my PhD research. So that was a really fun time to be able to sort of, balance those two opportunities. And I was there for 2 years, from 95 through 97.
And you then went to Bell Labs?
Went to Bell Labs. So I interviewed at a number of different academic positions, opportunities, finishing up at Harvard. And that looked kind of interesting to me. But I was always, drawn to the interface between science and technology. And Bell Labs in those days was like, the Yankees, right, of science and materials and technology and lasers and integrated circuits and so on. And so that was by far the most attractive place for me. And I decided to go there and spent 5 years. It was great during that time, and really was able to expand my areas of expertise and get into all new things. And that kind of Bell Labsian mindset really kind of has stayed with me and really shaped, the kinds of research programs that we've developed since then.
Then after Bell Labs, I think that's then you went to the University of Illinois Urbana.
That's right.
And then when I learned of you was a famous paper in Science in 2011.
Yeah.
And this was skin chips.
Yeah.
This was the whole idea of bioelectronics that you have pioneered. Tell a lot for the people who these are the medical community, but they may not all be familiar with this. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, right. That was an important paper for us. My core expertise is in electronic materials, and so I like to think about the future of electronics as a technology. And most people who are doing academic research in electronic materials are thinking about a future of electronics driven by Moore's law. So transistors are getting smaller and smaller, microprocessors that have more and more, transistors per unit area at higher and higher clock speeds, more and more sophistication and operation. I think that's a really compelling area for research, because to enable a continuation of Moore's law will require a lot of scientific discovery and new sort of academic insights into materials at those scales. But we have been interested in a different future of electronics, not so much driven by the critical dimensions of transistors or their switching speeds or their cost structures, but thinking about electronics as a possible interface to the human body, where you need to consider things around materials-level biocompatibility and maybe even more importantly, physical properties that enable an intimate integration of integrated circuit technology with the soft, textured, time-dynamic surfaces that you find in biology. quite a bit different than anything that's ever been present, you know, in commercial forms of integrated circuits, which are all built on the rigid planar surfaces of semiconductor wafers. So the question is, how do you build tissue-like electronics in terms of a soft mechanical modulus, an ability to bend and deform and softly laminate against the surfaces of targeted organs? And so this paper was a first demonstration of kind of all the key ideas around the material science, the mechanics designs, the device architectures, the system level considerations that allowed us to create skin-like forms of electronics. So in terms of thickness,
no, I mean, I remember the pictures from the paper in Science with these little skin chips on the forehead for electroencephalogram or the chest for a cardiogram. And this is mind blowing. Now, what I don't understand is, how did you move from this engineering background with chemistry and physics and everything into, I want to get into the body, I want to coalesce chips with the body? What was this that you're known as a bio-inspirational force?
Well, it's sort of an interesting story. So we got into this whole area of flexible electronics when I was back at Bell Laboratories. There we were developing new classes of semiconductor materials, polymer, plastic-based electronic materials. And the idea was that if you could create integrated circuits on sheets of plastic, you might be able to build new classes of consumer gadgets. And in particular, we're interested in paper-like flexible displays. And there's a whole, you know, interesting set of questions around the materials and how do you pattern them into circuits and what kind of, you know, new application opportunities would flow from that kind of technology. And we sort of continued those kinds of programs when I made the transition from Bell Laboratories to University of Illinois, but improving the properties of the transistors and those kinds of systems and the functional capabilities and so on. It turns out I was giving a talk in electrical engineering at University of Pennsylvania on this topic, large area flexible electronics, and there just so happened to be a few neuroscientists who saw the advertisement, the title for my talk, decided to show up.
Oh.
And they came up to me after the talk and said, hey, these are cool for, you know, large area steerable antennas for the military or flexible displays for consumer applications. Have you ever thought about putting these things on the brain? That would be really interesting, right? Because you could map electrical activity on the brain. And I had never really thought about that bio interface until that time. And it just struck me that was a huge opportunity. And so we started collaborations on that basis. We also were interacting with sort of the cardiologist folks at University of Pennsylvania's medical school. But understanding epilepsy turned out to be a focus area of interest. Using these sheets as diagnostic platforms, we're doing ECOG measurements at much higher resolution that would be possible just passive arrays of electrodes. So that's one thing. I kind of wanted to go in that direction. But as you probably know, you know, as somebody who's running an academic group, it's ultimately the students who have a large impact on where your research goes. And this was just such a compelling thing for the students. You know, I think they saw a lot greater and higher purpose in working on technologies that could have a positive impact on human healthcare than technologies that could be used for a new consumer electronics gadget.
I think
it was those two things that came together.
Well, you also have an incredible force. You have, what, 100? At least people in the lab working with you?
We've been running a pretty large group for a while, you know, and so I think it's not just quantity, it's quality.
I understand, but they're kind of electrified and they're really thinking about things, and you've pushed them along. Now, and you're very humble too, because I know where a lot of these ideas do come from. But I know some things that you've done since then, which it already was mind blowing. But then you developed like the Snapchat of chips in the body.
I've never heard it referred to.
It would disintegrate.
Good. Yeah.
I mean, it dissolve. It's self destruct. Whatever.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, Mr. Phelps.
Your
biochip will. Incredible. And then you had all these other ideas. Like you said, you had it on the brain and the heart, catheters with chips.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so picking up hydration, picking up, you know, things like blood pressure. Is there anything you can't measure with these chips?
Well, it's a good question. I think most of the sensors that we've focused on up to this point have, you know, really emphasized physical property measurements. So strains, stresses, electrical potential, temperature, things like that. I think the frontier is in biomolecular analysis, right? Biochemical rather than biophysical measurements. And so.
But not both?
Well, you want to do both.
Okay.
I think we can do biophysical.
You got that down.
We can probably do it, yeah. I'm still pretty comfortable in that realm. And maybe it's just a consequence of my own background and sort of physics and, you know, materials in that sense. But I think, you know, being able to sample biofluids and do quantitative analysis of important biomarkers, that's the frontier
well, yeah,
for
when,
us.
Yeah, when you published the Science Translational Medicine article covered with the very cool design sweat sensor that did lactate and electrolytes, and that obviously was a stunner as well. But where can that go? Can that, first of all, do you have to have actual sweat? Or can you just get it with that right on the skin?
Well, a couple of things. So right now we're just capturing sweat that's emerging from the skin in physical liquid form, right? And so the eccrine glands are acting as pumps to push that sweat into these microfluidic analysis networks. And we can do a lot once we have even sort of microliter volumes of sweat. We can route it around and do all kinds of analysis. But as you know, your body is constantly undergoing sweating. It's insensible sweating, right? So it's not enough liquid volume to form well-defined droplets. It evaporates almost immediately. And so we think there's a great opportunity for new device designs, new kinds of materials that can capture that insensible sweat. So you don't need to be physically exercising in order to capture this kind of biofluid. But that's an area of ongoing research for us.
I mean, it's tantalizing.
You think you'll be able to do it?
It
should be possible. I mean,
really?
If you look at a microscope, your skin, it's constantly, your sweat glands are constantly firing, right? I mean, you can see it. I mean, there's liquid there, but it immediately evaporates. So right now we can capture the water vapor associated with insensible sweat. We can condense it in our devices, and we thought we had the problem solved. But unfortunately, the evaporation process leaves all the biomarkers behind.
Well,
so you end up with, you know.
It's really fascinating, though, because if you can do that, that's like the holy grail here. Because then all these things correlate so well with what's in the blood, what's in the body. So that will be a big one. The one of the things that, since you, of course, moved to Northwestern just a year ago, and what I learned just from today is that you've taken these chips. They're no longer, you know, fascinating engineering breakthroughs. They're now in infants. They're in kids. Right. They're in intensive care units.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Right. I mean, I think that was one of the primary motivations in moving from University of Illinois, which was a fantastic place for me. I spent, you know, 13 very productive years there, great colleagues and so on. There is no medical school in Urbana. So we had been doing pretty well collaborating with med schools at different universities, you know, in Washington, in, you know, St. Louis and Penn. We continue to work with the University of Pennsylvania, you know, medical school and so on. But I think we perceived greater opportunities of being geographically co-located, you know, with an active medical school with researchers there. So that was kind of the main motivation. And you know, the move to Northwestern has really blown out, you know, the number of, you know, interactions we have with clinicians. And I think for us, a lot of this research, it's great to publish papers and do the, you know, educate the graduate students and so on. But I think we're defining success by proliferation of the technologies in a broader sense. And we need to push that. And the best, most effective way to do it is to get engaged very, very intimately with a medical school. So we have all kinds of human subject studies underway. As you mentioned, we have devices in the NICU, in the PICU, in the ICU. We also have a number of engagements with the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago, now called the Ability Lab. There's tremendous opportunities there. Parkinson's patients undergoing rehab from stroke, or studying aphasia, dysphagia, all kinds of stuff. Really just bandwidth limited by the numbers of students that we have in the group. I mean, I think the poll exceeds, you know, our ability to kind of respond to that.
What is so striking, if you see a picture of a newborn with all the wires attached everywhere in the head, all over the body, the wired world, and then you see, you know, two of your skin chips on the chest and the foot, and you say, oh, my gosh, this is a whole new world, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually really extraordinary. And these are the sorts of developments that will make ICUs and hospitals look unrecognizable, you know, using this kind of modern capability of monitoring, right?
Well, we hope so. You know, that's what we're aiming for. And I think that NICU use case was a pretty compelling one, where the skin-like form factor is absolutely essential. It's not just a convenience, right?
When you take these off, you hiss the skin in infants and particularly sick ones.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea that you can do this the way you've invented is just remarkable. And I love seeing the monitor orders with all the data that you couldn't even get from the old world. So
I mean, I think that's really the frontier. Is right now we're sort of focusing on reproducing the clinical tools that are used today, but making the devices much less invasive in terms of the tape-based interface to the skin and the heavy, you know, cumbersome wires and so on. But I think once you have a foothold, once you reproduce what's being done now, the ability to extend beyond, right, and do all kinds of measurements that aren't even possible right now. So we can measure cardiac auscultation, for example, is not done in the NICU today.
Right, exactly.
We can also measure pulse arrival times. So we can get blood pressure continuously, not done
today,
right? All kinds of opportunities. So that's kind of where we're looking, you know, in terms of the future research opportunities.
Well, you've touched on when you went to Northwestern, it gave you a much better opportunity to liaise with the medical community, I mean, directly, not through remote collaborations.
Right.
But what's holding back this engineering medicine coalescence? We need it to advance the field. You're the exemplar. Well, why do you think it doesn't happen more often?
Well, hard for me to say exactly. I mean, I can say, you know, from my own personal experience, it's the translational engineering parts that tend to be difficult to do kind of in an academic setting. There are relatively few funding streams that allow you to, you know, take what is developed science, sort of foundational science from an academic setting into meaningful human deployments in a clinical trial. That's a tricky business. We have had the good fortune that there's been engagement at the philanthropy level that help us to kind of solve that problem. But that's not a scalable model, perhaps, right, to get a larger fraction of the engineering community engaged in this kind of thing. So
So
I think there are opportunities for foundations or maybe the federal funding agencies to kind of look at this and think about whether it's useful to kind of place bets on that style of research. It's not fundamental science discovery, but it's an important piece because in order to get things out of the lab, you have to do these things, right?
Yeah.
And I think the results of that kind of work provide deep and important insights into guiding the scientific questions and the basic research. So I think it's an important piece. And, absent, funding specifically for that, it means you have to look for philanthropy. It means you have to start up companies and raise venture capital, resources. And it's time consuming. It's slow. It's not particularly efficient. So I think there's that aspect of the funding landscape that could really accelerate a lot of the work in this space.
Yeah. One of the, I think I mentioned to you, one of the things that I found most of interest about you was that you're one of the few engineers that ever had a profile in the New Yorker. And back a few years, there was the Body Electric. And tell us what it was like to hang out with a New Yorker journalist to be embedded in you with you in your lab.
Well, it was interesting. It was a great experience. It was a little nerve-wracking, to be honest with you, because she was, she spent two full days with me, morning to night, sort of shadowing me as I, went about my business. And she was trying to collect as much information as she possibly could to write the piece, right?
Yeah.
And so I put a fair amount of thought and advanced preparation into that so that, the meetings were such that she was able to kind of get the insights that she needed to write the article. But you never know how those things are going to turn out, right?
Oh, so it was a stunner.
It turned out pretty well. I was a little bit nervous. I didn't even read it myself until several months later. I just didn't want to look at it. But a lot of people have seen it.
I hope the Medscape community, those who are interested in this, will take the time to read it because it really tells a lot about you. And, it doesn't even mention the things that you've been recognized, like, for example, the MacArthur Genius or the MIT Lemelson Award or the Smithsonian Ingenuity, all these things that, the National Academy, of course. But you have done, you've been rocking. I mean, you've been really changing the field. And there are not so many pioneers who have taken engineering to medicine as you in a very distinct way. The other area that is, of course, a hot one right now is optogenetics.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if you're well into that too. Is that right?
We're pretty deep into that, yeah. So we had a paper in 2013 in Science where we sort of leveraged our ability to make very tiny, very thin semiconductor devices. I mean, that's kind of foundational for the skin-integrated devices, a lot of what we do. But those same ideas apply to LEDs, so light sources. And the conventional way to do optogenetic studies, at least of rodent animal models, is to use fiber optic cables developed by the telecommunication industry to deliver light to targeted regions of the deep brain. And that sort of works. The problem is it physically tethers the animal to an external light source. And so that physical tether has impacts on the natural behavior patterns of the animals, and it prevents the study of social interactions because two animals with fiber optic tether immediately get tangled up with one another. And so we begin to think about whether we could take these very tiny LEDs and just inject them directly into the brain, get rid of the external light source, get rid of the fiber optic cable, wirelessly deliver power to these LEDs down in the region of the brain of interest, and do optogenetics in that way.
Wow.
And it turned out to work. It's amazing that you can sort of do the thermal management at such a level that you don't damage the neurons that you're trying to stimulate with the light, and it becomes enabling. So we actually started a small company around that technology. We're getting a lot of inbound interest for access to the technology. We started a company. We launched products at last year's Society for Neuroscience meeting, and I think we probably have 30 systems worldwide now.
Oh my gosh.
Basically RF control box, the software interface, and then tiny implants that implant completely so they provide an ability to inject LEDs down into the deep regions of the brain, and then the wireless harvester sits subdermally. So the mice with these LEDs in their brains look exactly like a mouse that has not been modified in that way. So little mice running around with flashing LEDs in their brains.
It has some scary potential. You could see it for deep brain stimulation as a replacement.
Sure. Yeah.
So you wouldn't have to do what today, which is like a pacemaker for the brain, all kinds of hardware.
Sure.
And of course, as a research tool, it's quite remarkable.
Yeah.
What other areas, as you go forward, do you see that, the challenges, but also the big potential?
Yeah, well, we're excited about this area of transient electronics. You referred to it a few minutes ago, this idea of building electronic systems entirely out of constituent materials that are water-soluble, right, to biocompatible end products. And so the notion of a medicine, then, that's engineered around electronics that dissolve in the body is pretty attractive to us. So as an example, we have active programs in electrical stimulators that interface with damaged peripheral nerves and completely implant into the body. You can wirelessly then deliver electrical pulses to the nerve in a way that accelerates the rates of neuroregeneration. So you can accelerate healing in that way. And in that kind of context, you'd like a device that's ultimately bioresorbable because you don't need the device around once the nerve is healed. And so being able to build those systems out of purely bioresorbable materials becomes interesting as sort of an electronic neuroregenerative medicine, in a sense.
Yeah.
And so I think that kind of system, implantable devices that operate in that way, perhaps in the future, coupled to a sensing modality that allows a closed feedback loop type operation, is something that we think is an important future. So we have a lot of research efforts in that direction.
No, it's clear that you're moving beyond the sensing capability to the actual treatment.
Right, yeah.
It's pretty formidable. Well, you are... You're amazing, and I just think how young you are and how much a future impact you and your group and collaborators are going to have. So I can't thank you enough for joining us, John. Yeah. We want to wish you and all the folks at Northwestern continued just phenomenal success. So thanks to all of you at Medscape for joining us for this fascinating session, the bringing together of engineering and medicine. With one of our leading minds, and we look forward to bringing you more interesting folks like Dr. John Rogers. Thank you.
Thank you.